That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello and welcome to The Culture Bunker, your pop culture podcast roundup. I'm Sian Pattinson.
And I'm Andrew Harrison. This week we are thrilled to be joined by the pride of Leytonstone, prince of unclassifiable UK R&B, old mate of Mike The Streets Skinner, and podcast guru Merkage Dave.
And move over Kanye. Is this the hip-hop release of the year? We listen to Kendrick Lamar's long-awaited concept double album, Mr. Morale and the Big Steppers.
And Beam Me Up Sissy. Senior couple Sissy Spacek and J.K. Simmons have a portal to another world in their backyard, don't we all, in Amazon sci-fi thriller Night Sky. Will it send us to outer space to find another race or just up the stairlift to the stars?
Plus, we hear new albums from ex-Shaq chanteur Michael Head and, in sharp contrast, ex-One Direction pop star Harry Styles. All this and more on today's Culture Bunker. Welcome to the Culture Bunker. Let's say hello to our first guest. We are absolutely delighted to have Merkage Dave with us here today. Hello, Dave, or should we call you Merkage?
What's happening? Yeah, Dave's cool. Dave, David, that's all blessed.
Dave, David, that's how you should be known. Your album, The City Needs a Hero, is bloody brilliant and it's out next week. If you had an elevator pitch for this in a couple of sentences, what is The City Needs a Hero? And do we need these heroes?
I would say that in a party setting, you never want to be that person cornering another person, getting kind of intense about, you know, important subjects. You know, like stuff that you really care about, but maybe it's just not the time. You know, everyone's trying to have a good time.
We've all been there, haven't we, though? Yes, we go deep.
Yeah, exactly, right? So I stop myself from being that person by putting it on record.
Does this mean you're really boring at parties, Dave?
Yes.
Small talk for you.
People think I'm going to be fun, but I'm not.
That makes me laugh too much. Don't corner Dave at a party. As an honorary resident of Manchester, where you were for many years, is this an album all about cities? Explain the track, Please Don't Move to London. It's a trap.
Well, you know, my body is a city, you know. Please Don't Move to London, It's a Trap. Okay, it's funny because that was one of the first tunes that came out as a single.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah. With Awful Things featuring Caroline Polachek. It was like a double A. And people were like, man, I've just decided to move to London. Do you know what I mean? I just put a down on rent or whatever. And I'm just like, look, I'm not saying don't come here. You know, I love London. I grew up here. I'm back. But it's more like just the TripAdvisor, you know, just the, you know, the review.
If you're a bit older, you'd be writing a song saying, please don't move out of London, because that's 20 years prior. That's what everyone does.
Yes. Excellent. Let's meet our additional guest today. Johnny Davis is a writer about town. He was a longtime Esquire deputy editor. He has now joined the science fiction fashion company Volleyback, which makes things like jumpers out of firemen's helmets and underpants out of Kevlar and stuff like that. Hello, Johnny. Welcome back to the Culture Mugger. What on earth is going on at the forefront of exciting clothes for the future?
Hello, Andrew. Thank you very much for Fanshan and Dave. Thank you very much for having us back on. So Volleyback is a clothing startup, quite a small company at the moment with some big ambitions. And it's done all sorts of interesting things so far. It's made jackets for Mars and hoodies, indestructible hoodies and 100-year trousers. And at the moment, it's on a bit. Its latest release is a T-shirt using a new type of black, because basically black, mm-hmm. everything in from black ink in pens to the black on your mobile phones to black on bits of furniture is all out the ground. That's carbon black, very bad for the planet. So the idea is that we're on the hunt for a new black. And so the latest release is a hemp T-shirt made of hemp, and then it's printed, screen printed with algae, black algae.
Much better. Algae is the new black.
It's the future.
Is this an edible T-shirt? Should you stay away from swans and things like that?
I think you should always stay away from swans, Andrew. It doesn't matter what you're wearing. Naked, it's even worse to be naked.
Careful now, that swan could break your arm. You mentioned 100-year trousers. Now, I mean, generally we wash them because otherwise they start walking around on their own. What are these 100-year trousers of which you speak?
So it's a 100-year range, in fact. So there's a whole bunch of stuff which is designed to outlive you. So it's basically super tough, made with Kevlar. You mentioned Kevlar underpants. That's not. Looking ahead, I think on the wall chart we have in the office, there are underpants on there for maybe 18 months' time, but we haven't done that yet. But so 100 years, it just lasts forever, fireproof, windproof, rainproof, incredibly tough trousers, but also super comfy with lots of pockets and zips.
Well, the listeners may be able to tell that we are obviously having to record remotely. But I did see Johnny earlier in his 23-pocket high-performance apocalypse jacket. Is this correct?
That's correct, yes. So basically the idea is that, as you know, we're all, the doomsday clock at the moment is now 11 seconds to midnight. So, you know, anything could happen, possibly, flood, fire, pestilence, zombies as well. So they built the apocalypse jacket, which is a black lava resistant, corrosion resistant, chemical resistant, kind of massive, almost Liam Gallagher-esque, I might say, kind of parka thing that comes over your head and contains 23 pockets all around the inside. So the idea is you take all your stuff with you, everything you need when you're on the run, fleeing from your city or your home, whatever. Stuff your pockets with everything, passport, important license, and then off you go. Zombies can't touch you.
Astonishing. Have you got big pockets? So is there a women's collection, or is it a case of ain't no Volleyback girl?
Right.
Well, that's a question. It's a question that we get asked a lot, and that's I say, watch this space. There's certainly talk of that.
Amazing. A quick reminder, you can get the Culture Bunker and all our shows a day early and without adverts when you support us on Patreon. You'll be helping us keep going, and you'll get all manner of exciting merchandise too. Just search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out more.
Let's start off with music. The biggest release of the past week is undoubtedly Kendrick Lamar's Mr. Morale and the Big Steppers, released last weekend after much teasing. It's a vast double album, whatever album means these days. It's his fifth album, 73 minutes long, and still feels overstuffed with ideas. Rapper is too small a word for what he does these days. His 2015 album, To Pimp a Butterfly, was universally acclaimed for its merciless self-excavation. His 2017 album, Damn, won a Pulitzer Prize. I didn't even know there was a Pulitzer Prize for music. But with all black music now politicized, often for what, as much as, you know, for what it is, as what it says, Lamar kind of bears a burden of having to speak for all African Americans everywhere and a few more people besides. Ordinarily, we play a track to introduce you, but clearing tunes from these big ticket US guys is a non-starter. So we will drop the track Die Hard on the playlist. Right, what did we think? Sean, are you a fan?
I'm an enormous Kendrick Lamar fan. I absolutely worship at the altar of Kendrick, and I have been hammering this all week in an excited and almost overwhelmed state, because there is so much to it, and I think is his masterpiece. I think it's a work of genius.
I mean, the first thing we hear is, I've been going through something 1,855 days, and then he proceeds to demonstrate.
And he tells us to be afraid.
Yes.
Be afraid. Wow.
We hear everything that he's been going through. He's relentlessly personal. Me and my dysfunction, my lust addiction. What are you personally getting out of this, you know, tearing open of the rib cage?
Well, as you say, it starts with a track called United in Grief, and it is about this enormous catharsis. This is, you know, and he presents it, say the first few words are, this is what it's going to be. So you know this is going to be heavy. There is no other signposting, but this is going to be a big, big deal. And it kind of does make Kanye look a bit like Kylie, not Kardashian, but Minogue, in that, when he just goes, yeah, I'm really upset and my cat's just been sick. You know, this is really big stuff. He talks about being unfaithful. He talks about being on PC, he talks about God, he talks about all his friends and family. It's really hard going, but it's the honesty that just is jaw-dropping every single time. And there is so much to it, as we're saying, and I'm sure everyone's going to say this thing. It is, as I say, I've been listening to every day all week, and I am still hearing new things in it musically and lyrically. I think it is astonishing. It's hard to unpick in a way, because maybe that part of the problem is we shouldn't unpick it. It's a body of work. I mean, it is 5 years' work in a whole album, but it is absolutely astonishing.
You've just made me think about an as yet unseen pop star called Kanye Minogue, but never mind that. Merkage Dave, yes. I mean, you're an artist. He's done his own fair share of hard looks in the mirror. Where are you on Kendrick Lamar and this record in particular?
I mean, man, I've been Kendrick since Section 80, Good Kid, To Pimp a Butterfly. To Pimp a Butterfly is my favourite album of the century. then you know, you get that stadium moment with Damn, and I think this man is like, I think the first time I listened to it, I just sat and I was just so thankful for the message. Like, there's stuff that has not been covered in popular culture, let alone music, that he's covering, and he's just done it in a way. It's one of those records you kind of got to listen to the whole thing. I haven't been able to kind of like dip in and out of it, or I don't even want anyone to talk to me when I don't want to be doing anything. It's more like you're taking it in like it's a podcast, or do you know what I mean? It's like the second half of the record especially is just like when he starts touching on, you know, his aunt transitioning.
Yeah, there's a track called, is it The Anti-Diaries? Yeah. And it's like members of his family who have been through the trans experience. And he's kind of, you know, kind of thrashing himself for his own attitudes and the way that he had to change.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible just like positioning it from the point of ignorance and allowing people who may be ignorant themselves to kind of like empathize and understand another position. Mm. I think that's Kendrick's, it's his greatest strength, but I think it's the thing that tortures him the most is his empathy. His ability to see things from different perspectives and wanting to drag people into that position himself. But it's.
Merkage Dave, did you see that Heart Part 5 video on YouTube when he dropped it a few days before that? I mean, that's the empathy thing, isn't it, writ large, because it's a deep fake and it's him. Yeah. He's turning into these really, really controversial black figures. But it's, again, it's the mouth is on the floor, the jaw-dropping nature.
Yeah, I mean, when he turned into OJ, at first I was like, whoa.
Yeah. You can't do that. You think, of course you can.
Yeah. It
was, Kendrick.
Yeah. It was incredible. And finishing as Nipsey Hussle. And it almost feels like he's speaking as Nipsey Hussle. I mean, and the Heart series doesn't end up on any of his albums. That's just a separate thing. But I mean, you knew you were in for something after you got that, you know?
Dave, I wanted to ask you, I mean, you mentioned empathy, and I'm like, I'm the middle-aged white guy from the north of England, and like Kendrick's experiences and mine are pretty far apart. And this, you know, hip-hop has always done this, but I think this has done it in a new and an even more powerful way. To the likes of me, it brings home what it's like to be on the wrong end of racism, not just, you know, in yourself, but in your family history, in your community history, that how it shapes everything and how that comes out in anger to yourself, to your friends and your family, to the people around you. I mean, that's how I took it. But I mean, obviously your experience is going to be different. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, that was another thing that I was so thankful for, is just like the unpacking of generational trauma that goes back so far that it's something that I'm just working out now, you know, like stuff that happened during like slavery and colonialism that's still affecting people to this day. Mm. You know, like he talks about, you know, abuse, and how like his mum wouldn't believe him that he wasn't abused because she was abused, and that abuse kind of, and you know, there's this bit where he says, when you see these rappers these young guys, and they're kind of like beefing with each other and doing mad stuff on the internet. You have to understand that these are like abused people, a lot of them. And you never think about that. You might be like, what's that guy doing that for? Like, that doesn't make any sense. But when he kind of reframes things in a way that makes you go, wow. And you know, the generational trauma, how it affects the relationship between black men and women. I mean,
well, we've got to talk about that track, We Cry Together, haven't we? Which is him and the actor Taylor Page playing a couple having the worst domestic you've ever heard in your life. And there's long stretches of this track are just a fuck you, no fuck you, back and forth. It's incredibly raw, but it actually sometimes goes from funny to horrific to full of pathos to, you know, bizarre and ironic. I mean, what did we think of that?
Well, that's the empathy thing there, is because it's a dialogue, and usually you hear it from one person's point of view when they write a song like that. I think it's really unusual that it's theatricalized where you understand both people. I just think that's incredible. I think that's Kendrick's empathy, isn't it? It is amazing.
Dave, we've sort of talked about this beforehand, and you mentioned that you think this might be the hit single somehow.
Yeah, I really think by making the least commercial song, the first time I heard it, I was like, are you being serious? It was just, it just blew my mind. I was like, are you being serious? And then it's like, that is going to, it's the record that everyone's talking about off the album. It's going to end up all over TikTok for sure. You can imagine kids like miming to that. Like, you can see it, like it but it's like a play. Yeah, I mean, I forget the lady's name who's opposite.
It's Taylor Page.
Yeah. So, she's an actor. So it's like you're literally listening to like a play, and man, I mean, and like you say, like there's the elements of like really this like deep kind of like generational clashes that go from when like. You know, I've seen like documentaries about this stuff, how, you know, especially with African American and Caribbean relationships, like between men and women, there were like hundreds of years where they couldn't have typical relationships, you know? So it's like, you can hear that, but then there's like these funny moments where she's saying she blames him for, you know, Weinstein and R. Kelly, and he's like, no, but you still listen to his music. Yeah, it's just like those lighter moments and loving moments.
Yeah,
it's, man, I've just never, like, this is what you hope for. I mean, like, when I write, I want to touch on things which I think, like, just to solve problems. I think for me, I'm never trying to sit in a studio and just like come up with like something catchy. I'm always trying to like solve a problem that's either in my head or something that I see. And I think he's just done that on a level that, like, man, I'm just so inspired. I'm like ready to make my next one.
Yay.
Johnny Davis, what did you think?
I think it's really interesting you're talking about that track. I never thought about what Dave says. I'm sure that's completely right, that it's going to become this sort of cult thing, isn't it? I mean, it's elevating swearing to an art, isn't it? I think it was The Guardian that said it's compared to that Pete and Dud famous swearing.
I think exactly that just thing. Then, yeah.
So when I was at school, that was just became like the I mean, it's like, God, it's about, you know, 100 years old now, but it became a completely kind of cult thing because it was so sweary. But what I think is great about that thing is it's because the acting thing, maybe that's, it makes sense with that, with Taylor Page, but it sounds improvised, right? And it sounds like they're playing out, but it can't, because it's all on the beat. It's all, it's so tight. It's an amazing thing. I tell you what, you're talking about whether it's going to be big on TikTok for the kids. It's not big with my six-year-old, because it came on the kitchen and there was a bit of, I put them playing the album in the kitchen, it's a bit of effing and Jeff, and I thought, I'm going to get away with this until that track came on. And the six-year-old pipes up and says, Dad, this is not, come on. So I had to go off. But the whole album, it's just, it's one of those, not very often do you get a record, you put a record on and think, okay, I just don't know where this is coming from. Because you can normally hear influences, or it's a bit like that, or it's that time, is that whatever. But it's such a completely unique work of art that is also dealing with all incredibly difficult things, like Dave says, stuff that's not even been talked about anywhere apart, you know, let alone music. And yet it's super accessible. Like, the tunes are fantastic. The rapping is like, you know, tremendous and astonishing, and double time rapping.
Yeah,
there's ideas like bursting out of every single thing. And, you know, it's just like a, it's you just sit there with your mouth agape.
It's so
just,
rich,
God,
isn't
you,
it?
You know, you deserve, yeah, you just deserve every single accolade you get because you are ahead of everyone else. It's amazing.
It did remind me of one thing, although it's not the same. I'm thinking it's coming from the same place as Trouble Man, Marvin Gaye, which is soundtrack to a film, but it's about being really vulnerable. And it's so hard to be vulnerable, especially when everyone's going, I'm so vulnerable, look at me. He is, this is really ripped from him. You can really feel that. And we haven't mentioned Mother Eye Sober, the track with Beth Gibbons, which is just another thing of it just took my breath away. The whole thing. I hadn't heard anything like that before.
We also haven't mentioned the track Worldwide Steppers, which he puts himself in the most astonishingly kind of unsympathetic context. He's like, describes how he was basically having sex with white women as revenge on white women and white people in general. And you kind of think, did you really say that? Can you say that? But then you have to remember that, like, he has chosen to present himself like that. And the entire track is a discussion of why he felt that way and how he feels now about what he did. And none of it is flattering to himself. None of it is like, you know, I am this wonderful guy. The entire thing is him dissecting himself for himself.
That's because it's truthful and the truth is not sanitized. And that's why it is so astonishing, because it's truthful and it's honest. And most people put that on. Dave, you're saying, yeah, it's hard, isn't it? It's hard to be truthful and sound.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the first half of the album for me is the toxic half. And then the second half is the redemptive. Yeah. You know, and it's like a journey from pure rage, pain, towards like solution and also like taking off the shackles of the you know, as a fan of Kendrick, you've heard, he doesn't have like a messiah complex, but he has definitely, like, he wants to save everyone, and he realizes at the end of the album, like, I can't, that's not going to work, it's actually going to make things worse. I need to kind of take a step back.
To save himself, doesn't he?
I think the line is, sorry I didn't save the world. I think we can forgive him.
He's just got an enormous brain, hasn't he? I really recommend having the Spotify, like having the lyrics option on it, because it's kind of scrolls up while it's playing. Because it adds another dimension to it. And just think, oh man, you're like a proper brain. You're an incredibly clever band.
It's definitely a pause button album, because I kept having to go, hang on, what did you say? Did you really say that? You certainly get a lot of bang for your buck. It's fair to say then that we are all in rapturous favour of this record, are we not?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Release, well done, one of the releases of the year, maybe release of the year.
There you go.
Apart from Dave's.
Come on.
Yeah,
I've got a UK crowd. He can have the US one.
Yeah, fine. Yeah.
Now, more tunes. Every week, we ask our guests to bring in a current favourite track of theirs, an editor's recommendation, if you will. Johnny Davis, what's yours and why do you love it?
So this is not a new track, but it's the song All That. By Sparks, which I wasn't familiar with until I saw Edgar Wright's documentary, which came out last year. And what I love about it is it makes it super emotional, really makes me well up. And it's I suppose the substance of it is, it's kind of a thank you to a partner. One might assume that it's Ron Male who writes the words and the lyrics to Russell, and perhaps a sort of almost looking to the end of your life type thing. And there's just, what's great about it is, as typical of Sparks' writing, is that it's incredibly moving, and there's one joke in it. And if there was any more than one joke in it, it would tip over into being silly. And then the joke is, it says, you ignore my gaping flaws, and I see you and I'm in awe, and look outside, it's very nearly dawn. I can't believe my luck in meeting you. Hey, help me out, I can't find my left shoe. And that's the one gag.
That's true love and respect.
Sublime.
There.
Sublime.
Well, it is, you'll get no complaints from me about ever putting Sparks on this show. I do love this tune as well. We're going to add it to our rolling playlist. Links are in the show notes, and also play a little bit here. Here we go. This is Sparks with All That. Our guest today is Merkage Dave, down-tempo dance floor hero, as The Face calls him. When Mike Skinner broke up the Streets in 2011, he and Dave started running Tonga, a club night in Manchester that turned into a European tour with a lot of balloons involved. Then Dave jacked it in to make his first album, Merkage Dave Changed My Life, and hone his own mix of acoustic pop, soulful UK R&B, and wry commentary on real life. Now he's about to release The City Needs a Hero, his second album, full of tracks with beautiful melodies concealing sharp edges, and at least one song with good advice in it, as we have noted, Please Don't Move to London, It's a Trap. Here's a snippet from the album. This is an anthem for blazing youth called Us Lot. The trip stops and everybody gets off. If you like it or not, it's us lot that you've got. Remember, remember, it's us lot that you've got. Remember, remember, it's us lot that you've got. I might text you a question, the next week you reply with a meme. Dave, I've tried to describe your stuff, but it is impossible. It's like one-man acoustic tunes with compassionate vocals and gospel and hip-hop and rave textures, but not played at rave speeds. How do you describe what you do?
Yeah, I mean, it's something I'm still trying to work out. I think the closest that we've gotten is my friend. He's an artist from France called Orelsan. We were talking on the phone and he was like, "Man, I like your stuff. I'm trying to introduce it to people, but I don't know how to like describe it." And he said the closest he tells people that it's underground pop, which that's the closest. I think that, like, really, you know, when you talk about that, like, kind of combination of, the way you just described it was great. You know, that's the combination of influences, and I guess you would just call it pop. But I'm not white and 19.
It's like mature guy pop, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but like, you know, like David Bowie was pop, or Prince. Yeah. You know, like it's, you know, and I'm not comparing myself to those artists, but it's just more like, I think I kind of came through in an era where like pop was seen as it kind of got conflated with commercial, and I'm kind of, yeah, I mean, for me, it's a pop record, but it's just not a commercial record.
How did you come to this sound? You know, what were you into as a kid?
I mean, a lot of soul music in the house, discovered pirate radio, and by accident, you know, just from like going through the dial and just, oh, what's this? And then, yeah. Obviously fell in love with UK garage. Then when I headed to Manchester, I discovered a lot of, you know, when I was younger, I wasn't really into guitar music, but then when I went to Manchester, it was just like that kind of opened up a whole other space with me, and just kind of like really digging into like a different type of songwriting. And then like, obviously I ran clubs for club nights for years. So that, you know, you can hear that, and I've, you know, DJing and stuff, so you can hear that bit as well. And I guess like that is like the composite of the sound that you get.
You are known as a lifelong raver. Is it weird to love club bangers but kind of be drawn to making more reflective tracks on the acoustic guitar, the instrument we never hear in the club?
Yeah. Am I known as a what do you say, a
lifelong raver?
According to Andrew.
I didn't know I had that rep, mate. I think, do you know what? It's funny because when people come to London, they're always like, "Dave, I'm in London. Where am I going? Where are we going?" I said, "Bro, I don't know. Like, I don't even know." Like, I mean, I would actually love to have a club banger. I feel like I can't speak for every single musician or songwriter, but I feel like I would love to have it, but I wouldn't have it at the expense of the message. I think that's the hard thing, is it, you know, for me, I guess, what we're looking at, like a record like Talking Heads, Once in a Lifetime, or Hot Chip, Over and Over, or Wanna Be Starting Something, you know, like a record that is like, it's a dance floor record that has a message. And I think that's where I would, and I guess like on this album, I've come close, and there's some moments where it's like, yeah, like it's, you can, but I'm not gonna, for me, songwriting is all about, like I said before, it's all about like fixing something in your head, you know, to stop you from being that intense, you know, intense character at the party. So it's like, as long as I can always satisfy that, then I'd take it there for definite.
The world is changing. Some don't like it. It is actually quite a housey tune, but it's a very poignant lyric. Are you the kind of guy who's like in the club, in the corner, maybe like reflecting a little bit, sort of staring into the middle distance kind of thing?
I think that I'm hypersensitive. So I pick up on, like, if I'm in a club, I can see that person's upset. That person's a bit insecure. These two are going to have a fight in half an hour. Like, do you know what I mean? I can see all.
Yeah.
I can see all of that stuff, and you know, I traditionally know when to leave. Like, any time something mad has ever happened in a club, I've left before it happened. Oh, do you know what I mean?
It's wise, like, yeah.
I don't know if it's wisdom. I think it's just instinct. But it's just like, I'm just like hypersensitive in general, like, and like able to kind of like observe, and so like. Yeah, like I'm having a good time, but I'm always like kind of my like laterally kind of taking things in, you know.
How did you meet Mike Skinner and end up doing clubs with him?
Just by stalking him, really. You know, just someone put me in touch with his manager, who I think is a mutual friend of ours.
Tim Vegan, yeah. Friend of the podcast.
Our guy. And but you know, and I was kind of like, man, like, you know, I was trying to connect, but you know, it didn't happen at that point. But then a few years later, Mike came to Manchester when he started DJing, and I got booked to host that night, and he was just showing me a lot of love, bigging me up to the crowd that night, and this kind of went from there. We stayed in touch a bit, and I did like. It was like, yeah, because I had like a collective called Murky's Cartel, and like we did a remix of he was doing a thing called the DOT at the time, so we did a remix for that, and then like we were hanging out a bit more and then filming some stuff, and then he seen my club night, the Murky's Club, and he was like, wow. And then that's how we kind of, Tonga was basically the Murky's Club meets Mike Skinner, you know, and that was a great run in London. And then, you know, now we just send each other memes mainly.
Now, I've heard that people assume that because you're Black British, they refer to you as a rapper or, you know, grime artist Murkage Dave.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then you hear the tunes and you're like, this is not what you're talking about. This has got hip hop bits in it, but he's not a rapper and he's certainly not a grime artist.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that? The fact that people make an immediate assumption?
I mean, it is what it is, man. I think maybe it's, and it, you know, listening to, you know, you guys, even the way you're speaking about Kendrick Lamar, it's just a different level. But there's people that kind of like are commenting and talking about music that probably shouldn't be. If you think I'm a rapper, or if you think I make grind, then you probably shouldn't be a journalist, like a music journalist in 2022. Do you know what I mean? But yeah, we've just started putting. Murkage Dave is not a grime artist or rapper at the top of the press release, and that has seemed to fix it. I might take it back off and just
see what happens.
As an experiment, see what happens.
I like what you say though, underground pop. I think that's a really great, I mean, you know, it's all encompassing, but it actually is what you're doing. You are making pop songs.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
We're going to have another track from the album, The City Needs a Hero, which also opens with a bit of good advice. Do not read the comments. Life, words to live by there. This tune is World I Want to Live In. Tell us about it, Dave.
I mean, yeah, do not read the comments. I mean, I still do, but like, I'm only ever a couple of clicks away from seeing some horrible shit about like Black people or... but then the funny thing is like, you know, I clicked on... I seen Ian Wright, he reshared something about the Gay Gooners group. And then you go in the comments and it's the same guys saying the same shit, kind of shit about that. And I was like, okay. Like, so these lot are just going around and anything they're just saying, it, you know, these burner accounts, they just attack stuff that is like, if they think, you know, if they're threatened by it or whatever, they just attack it. And so it was just like, how can I... There's two things. It's just like, I want to kind of examine that kind of paranoia that social media gives you, especially if you're like a member of some kind of like a what's the word, like a disenfranchised group or whatever, but mm-hmm. also just like to try and encourage empathy between the groups, because I've got friends, I've got black friends that are homophobic, or I know like white girls that are feminist but think, oh, like racism is just a bit of a too much of a fuss. And it's just like, hang on a minute, like put yourself in each other's position, you know. So that was, it was kind of like trying to like find a way to kind of like illustrate, I know it's kind of like a bit of a cheesy idea, but just kind of like trying to illustrate how, you know, show each other the other side, you know.
Well, both tracks are on the playlist, Ocelot and World I Want to Live In. And because Dave's a good egg, he's let us play a good chunk of World I Want to Live In rather than the usual 30 seconds. So basically, big up Merkage Dave.
Do not read the comments. Are these the people that I sit on the buses with? Crack a window, man, I need some air. It gets hot on the upper deck, doesn't it? I look down on the street, see strangers. Are they behind these accounts with no faces? Or just walking around ordering coffees? They see me living my life and wanna stop me. But if I come as I am, will you accept that? If you arrive broken, will I be blessed with that? 'Cause my pain is different from your pain, but we know the pain exists. We've all been through different things. I know you're tired of the fight. What if I decide to fight with you? That's the world I want to live in. Do not read the comments. Close the app, put the phone back in my jeans. Avoid the cracks on the street, in the pavement. If I pay enough attention, it could make all the cease. I see the trees fight as the wind gets stronger.
Let's have a bit of TV, shall we? What's at the bottom of your garden? A busted wheelbarrow? Bins? A dead fox? Or perhaps a portal to another world? That is what the legend that is Sissy Spacek and her husband J.K. Simmons, who you'll recognise as J. Jonah Jameson from the Spider-Man movies, have at their backyard in Amazon Prime's new sci-fi series Night Sky. Does science fiction work in the context of age, loss, regret and confusion? It certainly works for me. Here's a taster.
I get it's a heck of a view.
Oh, it's more than that.
Maybe it's time we finally tell somebody else.
Hey, Grandpa. I think you two should consider moving out of the house.
That's what you're worried about?
One of your neighbors saw you pushing Nana around in the middle of the night.
But I think they're hiding something in that shed.
There's a reason. We were the ones who found this. This is our riddle to solve.
Merkage Dave, are you a science fiction head, and what did you make of Night Sky?
I am, mate. Well, am I a science fiction head? I'm a fan. I'm a fan. And I like this because it's like, you know, the geezer from Juno.
J.K. Simmons.
Yeah, man. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, I was like, that's my guy. And like, you know, I don't know, there's something, it's a bit like that device in like a horror movie where you have a kid and they're, you know, so it's like your brain goes, oh, you see these people are like nearing the end of their life and they're, you know, they're considering their mortality. They seem kind of vulnerable, but there's this kind of like love between the two of them and they're like very kind of like, you know, they're in their own world, they're in their own bubble with each other, you know, like they love each other deeply, but then there's this secret, there's this,
yeah,
there's something there, you know.
And the portal to another world has kind of got, it's quite symbolic in the sense that, like, the Sissy Spacek character is very drawn to it, to the extent that she wants to go further through the portal. She wants to open the door onto the surface of this other world that they're on, in a way that would definitely risk her death. Whereas J.K. Simmons has almost become jaded with the idea of being transported billions of light years to the other side of the universe. He's like, we've done this 850 times. Are we going to keep doing it? There's a kind of a tension in the marriage there. And, you know, it does take a while to get going. The first episode is quite slow, isn't it? But when it starts to move, we see that not only does this extraordinary thing that's in this very, very ordinary life start to exercise tensions on the two of them, but also it's maybe not the only portal in the world. And there are other people from other parts of the planet in very, very different lives are also having their lives distorted by this extraordinary thing in their midst. I found that pretty interesting. Sian, what did you think?
I thought that the first episode is really slow, and there are points where it seems to be a little bit sentimental. There's a lot of piano music underneath, which is trying to guide us through, aren't they a lovely couple? Aren't they old? Isn't it sad that they're nearly dead? And that's how I didn't like being guided by that. But episode two, all these other characters pop up. You realise that if you get really drunk, you really want to show your portal to the neighbour, as it were. And suddenly,
I'm sorry.
It's Friday night. And at that point, there were lots of different plot points come up, and there are lots of strands, and there are some sub-stories there, if you see what I mean. And suddenly, you see, you can do this with it, you can do that with it. I know J.K. Simmons, as it were, from Whiplash. So I'm used to him sort of cracking the whip and being really quite evil. To see him act in this, you just, you're really good. Oh, you can do something completely different. So watching the couple and watching him and Sissy navigate this relationship and change. I love the fact that he's jaded. I love the fact he's a shrug emoji, isn't he, about being able to go to space. And you think, really, you know, there is so much in that, and what his character is doing to be so blasé about that. It gets more and more interesting. And I started to hoover it up and watch four.
And we were sort of chatting off mic on this, that you saw symbolism in the two-way portal may have a bit of resonance to Trumpiness and perhaps, you know, the fear of the immigrant coming through from elsewhere.
Well, yes, it's the fear of the alien, isn't it? The illegal alien. And there's very much an idea of what is other in a relationship. You can know you've been married to someone for decades, but not really know them. And, you know, because I like the idea that maybe Sissy is sitting there in space because she is identifying with something that is so alien. There's all sorts of permutations that could crop up with this, which I thought just made it more exciting in a narrative way towards the end. And I definitely do think there is something about how we trust other people and how we trust people from a different, not necessarily race, but, you know, just a different world from ours, even if they are the neighbour next door or someone who works at the care home, for instance.
Yeah, because one of the sort of subplots is the younger couple who live near them and next door, who J.K. Simmons just cannot stand, conceives an irrational dislike of.
It gets more complicated than their relationship with the neighbours and what the neighbours are actually doing. And I thought that was really good storytelling.
Johnny Davis, you were less enthused, weren't you?
I've also seen four, and I agree with everything you're saying, Sian, but I sort of felt in reverse. So the first one I really liked for the reasons that we sort of know portal movies almost as a sort of genre in themselves, and they can be sort of wacky, like Being John Malkovich, or they can be weird, like Twin Peaks with its red curtains, or they can be sci-fi, or they can be hold a mirror up to reality, like Black Mirror, and this didn't do any of those. And I thought, okay, that's cool. This is going to be original and different. And I loved all the old stuff. I love the sort of the cozy relationship they have, and the fact there, as it goes on, maybe she's hiding something, maybe he's hiding something. What is the portal? They visited it 856 times, we're told, according to Frank. They never dead open. There's a door, isn't there, they can go through.
Yeah.
You're thinking she's going to die if she goes through. Is that true? I guess she said the point where she leaves a note, doesn't that? It implies that.
Well, they certainly say that he released some mice out of the door and they didn't last long. So yes. Which I thought was really cruel against mice.
You're right. Okay. Yeah. But then there's only, as you say, there's these other, in the second episode, it suddenly jumps to a apparently separate storyline in Argentina with a mother and daughter. And there's three or four, maybe more of these things that sort of jump in. And that's fine. And you assume they're all going to link up and the portal is somehow connecting them all. After four, it's not really getting anywhere. And it just becomes less and less interesting to me. I would say that, you know, that there's nothing really to spoil, because so far nothing's happened. It's all in the first one. But I like the set of the old, having old people as old people, having people of a certain age as the protagonists in a sci-fi film is really cool. Yeah. I thought that's the nicest thing about it. I think that's my favorite bit about it.
Yeah, we're not that far off ourselves, Johnny. So that's what I've got.
Old speak for yourself,
I liked it. I thought it was a great concept. I agree that it is perhaps a little bit poignant and a little bit heavy and a little bit sort of heavy going. At one point, I was thinking I didn't know the Hallmark Channel was making science fiction these days, but it does kind of generate an energy of its own. My fear is that we might be in for a Lost where, you know, many, many questions are set up and then I can't quite wrap them up and bring them together at the end. But that said, I did find it. I mean, it's not at the same level as say, a Severance, where you really are absolutely wrapped in tension at all times. But, you know, it's pretty good.
The Severance, I think we're giving... in that good way, is really intellectual, isn't it? It's about an idea and a concept. And this is about relationships between people. I think it's very different.
Yeah. Relationships between people.
So boring. You know what I mean.
So there's a qualified yes.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, time for another favourite tune from one of our guests. Merkage Dave, what current tune have you got in your bag of vinyls?
My current tune, I mean, it could have been, do you know what, anything off of this album, the Fontaines DC album. Mm-hmm. Yes, they've got me back. They brought me back, man, because guitar music has kind of been a bit boring for me for a minute, but they got me back in the room.
Yes.
And, I could have picked anything and I've picked one of the singles, the big single, Jackie Down the Line, because, you know, I could have picked a cool, gone for a cool pick, but I feel like,
album track.
Just to be a bit more, I'm that guy, you know, but I think songwriting wise and vibe wise, that was the one where I just listened, I thought, man, I wish I wrote that. Not that I could, you know, I'm always going to write something different to that, but I just think the feel of it and the vibe of it just bowled me over, you know.
Could you do the accent though?
Go on, give it a go.
I mean, most British pop singers, R&B singers, they sing in Black American accents, and no one even says anything. So maybe I should do that. Maybe I should start singing in an Irish accent.
I've never understood this since I was a kid. Why does pop music happen in American?
Ask Paul.
I never understood it.
Yeah, it's the singing style. Yeah, the singing style is based on a pronunciation that is American. But yeah, Paul McCartney, he's to blame. Love him. I'm not hating.
As ever, we can't clear it, but we will be whacking it on the playlist that is in your show notes. And on to more music. The patron saint of Liverpool songwriters, Michael Head, and his Red Elastic Band releases the first album in 5 years with Dear Scott. The title is from a postcard F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote to himself when he arrived at a hotel in LA. He was washed up, but sober. Will we identify?
I think we will.
And the pikelet of pop, Harry Styles Goes Large and Goes Home with Harry's House, his third album. It is not to be confused with the Joni Mitchell song of the same name, nor the Susie and the Banshees hit.
Were Harry Harry's here house, in the Harry
Harry's
house.
House? Yeah, get it, yeah. clearing Harry Styles. Yeah, that was really good. Of course, it's a fool's errand, but we will be putting Daydreaming on the playlist. Meanwhile, here's Michael Head and the Red Elastic Band with Broken Beauty. Broken beauty and the state you're in. People try to put you down, they don't win. Mother Superior, it's a sin. Johnny Davis, I will start with you. Jangly, jingly, jangly. How genned up were you on Mick Head before you heard this?
Well, he surfaced mostly for me a long time ago with his band Shaq, with their sort of, I guess, the most popular album in 1999, which was called HMS Fable, which was more jingly, jangly. and that was quite nice at the time. It had sort of more orchestration to it because there was probably a bit more budget around back then. And for me, it's not my favorite record I've heard recently. It's fine. It's a jingly jangly record made by in a sort of indie pastiche. I'm obsessed with the band Love type way. It's fine. I wasn't really hearing the tunes. I didn't really get the big concept. It's all very well talking about hotels and Scott Fitzgerald in your press release. I wasn't feeling it. The ideas weren't coming through for me. I thought it was all right, but I'm going to pass on Mick Head.
Right. He is sort of the great lost musician. He never really made it big when everyone thought he was going to. He deals with the minutiae. This is all observation, which probably he couldn't do if he was famous. Who does this appeal to, Johnny?
That's a good question. I'd really like. I'm interested to know where this record sits in 2022, because it seems, you know, slightly anachronistic in 1999. Cause it was a throwback then. do you know what I mean? That sounds mean. I hope he has got a devoted fan base in it, and it's happy days for people who are his fans, because obviously he's really well loved.
I think he does have a pretty devoted fan base. There are people who live and die by Mick Head's music.
Mm,
yeah.
Andrew, you seem to be from Liverpool.
Worth that out.
I've got this idea. What do you think of this album?
You have to like it.
Well, I'm from posh Liverpool. I'm from the outskirts. I'm a borderline woollyback. I do like it. I mean, I think he sings in his own accent, but he also writes in his own accent. Mm-hmm. It's very kind of vividly about his hometown. There are bus journeys on this record, which I recognise. I'm around Newsham Park and this kind of thing. Mm. And there is, I think, I mean, he is almost the kind of platonic ideal of the Liverpool musician, writes about his community and the people around him, you know, very acutely observational, spots little things and blows them up into big episodes, little things that mean a lot. Is kind of, sort of lives by his own standards, has never really gone for the mega, the mega let's go huge move, partly because of his own well-documented personal, flaws. Shaq were, no strangers to the world of drugs. Mm-hmm. And that kind of gives it a poignancy. The poignancy in his career and the poignancy in the songs are of the same stripe. So, I mean, it's not absolutely square in the middle of my main area of excitement and interest. It's a bit light on drum machines, dub bass lines, and acid house motifs. But for that, for all that, I think it's a beautifully realized version of what it's trying to be. And there are certain string flourishes on this that are just absolutely gorgeous. Mm-hmm. Like I say, I like the fact that he sings in his own accent, because it sort of takes one foot out of pop music and into kind of, reportage of where you're from.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's novelistic in that sense, isn't it? I suppose if you're he's narrating the stories and the things around him.
Go so far as to say it's novella-istic, because they're little snippets. They're little, they're,
Wouldn't you?
I would. Well, I would, because I'm a Ponce.
Yeah, yes. Dave, what did you think of it?
I mean, I'd never heard of this geezer before.
Okay, yeah.
So, like, I'd come in with no expectations, no context. It went down well with the Weetabix this morning. It was cool, man. Just it's nice to listen to. I think there's a couple of tunes at the end where I guess they get a bit more. Yeah, there's a bit more kind of movement and like emotional movement that I liked. But it was cool. I think I need to go back. And, I feel like there's a lot lyrically and like conceptually that I missed, because I was just taking it in like it was just a nice to listen to.
Yeah, you were doing record. A first listen thing. Yeah.
Yeah, so I had no clue. Yeah.
One of the songs is about two childhood friends who lose touch, and one of them is then trans, and they still have this amazing bond, although it's not a romantic bond. There's another song that is about sex workers who take, the Pretty Fly song in Night of the Hunter with Robert Mitchum. Right. They take that, it's called Pretty Child, and he moves that and puts it in. So there's a lot of storytelling in there, but I think you're right, you probably sort of miss it on first or second listening. It's quite...
I think that's a challenge for me as a writer. Yeah. It's like, I'm trying to tell that story, but trying to make it land as well, And
I think you and here in a similar area, actually, because it is about observing the things that most people ignore that actually mean more than the things people pay attention to. And sort of, instrumentally, there are some things in common, the sort of beauty of the simply played acoustic guitar. Dave, if you can imagine yourself a middle-aged white guy in Liverpool, then,
What he needs... to do is really for me to add some beats and sex to his music.
Okay. We don't do that round our way. We don't do that. That's London does that.
That London.
Well, maybe all right. Yeah, that London. There are lovely lines in it and things that I really couldn't tell the difference between R. White's and Lucozade. And obviously that means something really important, but I'm not still sure what it is. And there's a bit that says the tracks of my tears was on the radio. There are things that leapt out of me like that, that I thought were really beautiful vignettes. Mm. But yeah, it's submerged in that jangle so much that maybe it needs a bit more digging. Should we move on to Mr. Styles and Harry's house? Andrew, you're a big pop fan, are you not? What did you think of probably the pop release of the year?
So I was surprised how much I enjoyed this, actually, because, I mean, you'll be amazed to learn. I've not been following Harry Styles' career all that closely. He seems like a nice young lad, but, you know, it's pretty far away from my wheelhouse. Mm. And I was listening to this as I strolled across the Highbury Fields in Media Elite North London this morning, and I just felt great. It is beautiful, light, unpretentious, you know, grown-up pop music of a very fine grain with a lot of good weird noises on it. Actually, I think it has the feel of pop with the kind of the textures of not pop.
Mm-hmm.
It also felt like it had a lot in common with, you know, those two Slow to Disco compilations we've done a couple of times on the podcast in the past, where kind of Crate Diggers have gone into that strange phase in the mid-70s where the adult-orientated rockers discovered disco and discovered synthesizers and discovered that they could take their beautiful sheen and kind of mechanize it a little bit. And basically everybody starts wearing white suits and aviator sunglasses.
Mm.
It has that vibe. And I think that suits Harry's personality very well, because he's very much the young English lad going to make it big in that environment. It has no big statements. It's got nothing grand to say. But is it not a more radical thing now to just try and do beautiful, mood-elevating pop music when absolutely everything else in the world is dedicated to depressing your mood?
I'm not sure I can go with that. I like the thought that it starts with a track called Music for a Sushi Restaurant, which is surely a nod to Brian Eno. Music for Airports, Sushi Restaurant. There we go. Johnny, what were your thoughts on the big bangers of Harry?
Yeah, I absolutely loved it. I think that to go with the Andrew's comment about the weird sounds, and there's really lovely little lyrical touches in it. There's a line about high speed internet in the single. Just drops in sort of references that really I thought was really good writing, actually. And the sort of the template for the album is that kind of you mentioned Too Slow Disco and synth pop and Prince kind of 80s thing that's very much around at the moment. The single is another rewrite again of Blinding Lights, and The Weeknd's Blinding Lights, which was itself a kind of splicing of Take On Me and a Maniac.
Yes.
And has been done by Coldplay's Higher Power and that Ed Sheeran song Overpass.
Did you not have a theory that this is the song that everyone can just rework every couple of years, which is an amazing theory? If it was just sitting there on a shelf, you pull it out, release it, put it back again.
But it's such a good song that even though you go, oh yeah, I've heard this basically be covered now four times in the last year, it's still great. You still don't think, oh, I'm bored of that thing. And and also, you know, good luck to him. I watched the video for the video. What's the single called? I forgot what the single's called now.
As It Was.
As It Was, exactly. The single for that, when he's in his sequin jumpsuit with his tassel, you just think, wow, you're a fine specimen of a man, aren't you? It's not hard to see why he walks out of Coachella's crowd, audience, and people just go nuts. And as a pop star, there's not been a British ex-boy band member who's broken America, and he's done it 10 nights at Madison Square Garden.
Robbie Williams didn't quite pull it off, did he?
No, and he does wear it extremely well, whereas Robbie Williams in a dress didn't look so good, quite frankly. Dave, Harry's calling card seems to be devotion. These songs are about this one love that he is not going to veer from. And it's very, I mean, it's good for the fan base because it's almost talking to them. I will love you forever. This is what we're going to do. It's very plain in that way, lyrically. What did you think?
I mean, annoyingly, I press play. Mm-hmm. And I started taking it in, and then about four songs in, I realized it. Spotify had done me dirty and just put it on random. So
it shuffled you.
Yeah, I've only given it the one play, and I just felt like for me it was just like a luxurious kind of like soulful record. I mean, compared to the last one in my head, if I remember, was more like Bowie-esque, and this one is more like soulful, and it sounds like it cost a lot
it's
to make.
It's Young Americans.
Say again. Sort oh, it's his Young. Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. It's that phase. It's that phase. Yeah, it's a very lush, beautiful record. I need to take more time with it. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Personally, for me, I'd love to hear him maybe talk about what's going on inside. I mean, I'm sure there is. There was like that Matilda. Is it Matilda?
Yes.
Yes.
That's that one hit me. But I'd love to hear, you know, like what man's going through. But I guess maybe that's not what he's there for. Do you know what I mean?
Gotta be said that Matilda is the most Murkage Dave tune on the record. Gotta be said. It's quite Murkage, that one.
Right.
Little Murkage. I like the fact that I think his only print promotion seems to have been Australia's Better Homes and Garden magazine.
That's
which is
right.
Totally perfect. That's you know, that's what pop stars should do. They should wear Gucci dresses and they just do homes and gardens and they just have a fantastic life that you want to copy. I've listened to it today more so than in the morning, and in the morning I felt quite judgmental. No, I like it more and more. I just think it's so gloriously let's just fuck about and have a nice time, you know. Just thought, oh, why not? So yes, I'm veering towards the Andrew view. Veering
there
slightly.
You go.
Yeah,
your pleasure is radical in and of itself.
Yeah, and he's not gone super camp yet. It's not Elton John. It's still, it's, you know, it's heartfelt stuff, you know. It's not not too many layers of irony on it quite yet.
I like the way he references himself as well. I like Harry's House. That's a great title for an album. It's just a great thing, isn't it? The world's a better place because he's made that record.
Yeah,
it's good.
Also, excellent children's television program. Harry's House.
So we're generally saying we pretty much like it.
We are saying hurry or parry. Come on. Finally, regular listeners know we always ask our guests to choose their favourite song of all time to add to our playlist. It is unfailingly difficult to do. That's why we make them do it. Murkage Dave, what is the greatest song of all time and why?
I mean, the one that I went for, because this did spin me, but like the one that I went for is Stevie Wonder, He's Mr. Know-It-All.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously taken from the Inner Visions album. I mean, Stevie Wonder in the 70s was just like on a run, man. He was prophecy, like that whole decade. I think it gets overlooked. I feel like because of I Just Called to Say I Love You, there's like a stigma with, but I feel like you can't let one song overshadow. Do you know what I mean? Like, like the Beatles did a lot of whack shit after, like, do you know what I mean? But it's just like, you can't let that overshadow.
But it's up to 73, 74, where he just has this amazing run, as you say, doesn't he? It's just, there's no duff albums at all. They're so wide ranging. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah. And for me, I guess like Inner Visions definitely like kind of like thematically inspired The City Needs a Hero. I wanted to make a record that kind of like, dealt with the issues of the times and put you there, but also would last way beyond it. And I think He's Mr. Know-It-All is the perfect example of that, where it's like, you know, you've got this record, he's talking about, people say he's talking about Nixon, but, you know, I was listening to this record during the pandemic and I was thinking of Trump, I was thinking of Boris, and I feel like you can take it and apply that song. It's like a beautiful pop song that you can literally just enjoy as a beautiful pop song without even thinking about what he's saying. Or you can take it and apply it to whatever guy thinks he's the, you know, the top, he thinks he's got the big bollocks that decade. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's going on the playlist. Johnny Davis, what's your take for the greatest song in all history of songs?
the best song ever made, ever written. Well, it's obviously
ever.
So obviously Under the Influence of Love by the Love Unlimited Orchestra. Partly because there's a lot of talk at the moment about the 90s because it's come around again because it's that long ago. And the thing that I think that is remarkable about the 90s is just it was the time when everything got mixed up, right? So the photo that sums up for me is there was a photo when Tricky went out with Björk for about a week. There was a photo of them walking out together, and it just seems so bizarre. Not because partly because they look they're two incredibly looking people, but also because they're from such different worlds. And that kind of was the 90s, right? It was all mixed up for the first time before Spotify and before playlists. And so this song was played at the club, the Heavenly Social, the Sunday Social, where it seemed kind of revolutionary to play hip hop next to the Beatles, next to this. And they would always play this. And I think they even put it out as a promotional sort of CD for it. And at the time, I put it on a couple of playlists for people. And is it the greatest song of all time? Maybe. It's just a really great, a great tune. And yeah, that's my choice.
Well, it will not be a surprise to the listeners to know that we can seldom clear the enormous classics like these, but they'll both go onto our rolling playlists. Check the show notes. Listen to them right now.
And with that, we're at the end of the podcast and it's closing time chatter. What will we be discussing as we retreat to the Hollywood Hills and make ourselves maybe a nice bowl of Weetabix, like Dave? Dave, what's your closing time chatter?
Man, I mean, like, this is something that, like, I immediately laughed at and then, you know, was brought to tears by is George Bush. I don't know where he's speaking, but he was being quite critical of Russia and he talks about an illegal invasion and he means to say Ukraine and he says Iraq by accident,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then he goes, oh yeah, that too. And then he goes, sorry, I'm 75, man. And it's like, hilarious. It's like, is this literally like, it feels like a episode of The Simpsons from like, you know, back then. And but it's like actually happened in real life. But then, you know, when those laughs, you know, he gets a laugh and I'm thinking, man, like no one, like so many people died in the Iraq War and you can just make that joke about it. And it's like, I don't know, man. I think there's something about, you know, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, during 2020, like Black Lives Matter and stuff, and there's so much debate. But I think really what it comes down to, I mean, you know, it's Brown Lives Matter or whatever, but it's just like the idea that, I don't know, man, I just think that, like, you know, I'm all for, you know, supporting, you know, like Ukraine and like, you know, like there's been an aggression against them. But I just think that, like, we can't put that above the plight of other countries, which I think we definitely are doing. And so I think there was two things there. It was just like, man, this is like the most memeable shit I've ever seen. But then also like, but that's what my brain does. You know, I'm kind of doing it to you guys right now. Imagine if you were at a party and I was saying this to you, you'd be like,
"Ah, you're doing this bit."
Yeah, yeah. You'd be like, bro, chill.
Yeah, we're going, no. Yeah, I just got to go to the loo, Dave. I'll just pick up.
Exactly. And that's why I've got to put it on record.
Bless you. Johnny, what is your closing time chatter?
Well, mine is much more shallow than that and sticking with the 90s theme. It's about Liam and Noel Gallagher. And I noticed they're both performing shows and it sounds like I'm being mean-spirited. That's not what I'm interested in, really. So Liam's playing two nights at Nebworth, 160,000 people. Mm-hmm. And Noel is playing Margate, Dreamland Margate and the Kenwood House, but he's on a bill or on a week, you know, on the poster with James and Culture Club. And I just think, like, who is he happy with that? Who's booking his gigs? Noel should not be on a bill with Culture Club. That's weird. And also, so Liam's performing, he's getting the big tickets, he's getting the sales, he's getting all these people through the doors in quotes of Nebworth. And yet, I guess Noel gets the money from the songs he's playing. So who's the more fool? The fool or the fool who follows the fool? That's what I want to know.
I think they're both getting exactly what they want. Liam is getting the roaring arenas of mental people in bucket hats screaming at him. And Noel, who was always kind of gritting his teeth a little bit of that, gets to play at a quiet country house thing.
Yeah,
he gets to play all the stuff from High Flying Birds that maybe perhaps the Bingley Bongley Manchester continuity mafia don't necessarily want. But he also gets all the cash from the PRS. Yeah. I think they've got it absolutely sorted myself.
They're both happy.
You think they both win?
As happy. Yeah, I think they're both. I think it's a win-win situation. Our kid.
Okay.
What's your closing time chatter, Andrew Harrison?
Well, we're back to morons misspeaking themselves. It's Nadine Dorries, my favourite Nadine Dorries.
Your favourite Nadine.
Yeah, she's up against she's up at the Culture Select Committee talking about privatizing Channel 4. Mm-hmm. And the consultation, the open consultation to everybody to find out who's in favor of this. She says to the committee chair that the consultation found that 96% of people supported the notion of privatizing Channel 4. And the committee chair had to say, actually, Mrs. Dorries, 96% of people were against it, were opposed to it. You've got it completely the opposite way around. And she didn't resign on the spot or say, oh my God, I'm so sorry. She just did that stupid face that she does.
I know that face. I've seen that face.
I know that face. Yeah. It's strange. I've seen that face before. Yeah. And so it's almost
the Alan Partridge shrug, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It's like, you know, my point stands. No, your point doesn't stand. You're a horrible moron. Yeah, I know. But it just seemed to be that was everything in a nutshell. Yeah. That, you know, like you can sit there in a Commons committee, say the absolute opposite of the truth, and when you are exposed for it, just go like a kid, you know. So that's what's driving me up the wall this week.
Dave, what are you going to say to that?
I just think every time I see her on the television or on the internet, I just want to know what she's smoking and where can get. That's all I think.
It's another T-shirt. Get another T-shirt with that on it, Dave. Hey.
What is Nadine Dorries smoking?
And where can I get it?
Smoking. That's quite nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll work it out afterwards.
Sean, what's your closing time chatter?
My closing time chatter, of course, is Disco Scallops, Andrew.
Is this a euphemism?
It certainly isn't. Marine scientists in Devon were trying to catch crabs in a really eco-friendly way. And what they did is get a big pot and they put LED lights, thinking, hey, the crabs are just going to go wee into this pot and we can catch them and nothing else will get caught and everything will be fantastic. Crabs were just like, no. Are we stupid? LED lights? That's really, really crap idea.
Were the crabs giving it all that with their little claws?
Yeah, yeah. They were certainly doing that. However, the scallops apparently have 200 eyes, looked at the LED lights and went, "Whoa!" And there is film of this in the article that I was looking at, of them gleefully jumping into this pot with LED lights. And there's also a fantastic picture of the two scientists on a boat holding a scallop, looking like the happiest people you've ever seen. So Disco Scallops. I mean, the sad thing is that they have to die after they've been in the pot, but maybe they could just have like nice pots that are fun for the scallops and then they just leave them there and people
don't release them in the wild. Yeah. What dedicated raver wouldn't want to end their life smothered in garlic butter and pan seared?
And it is the best way to go, isn't it? To look at a light, think woohoo,
yeah.
And have your last moment of ecstasy and then
there's worse.
Die. There is.
There you go. I'm absolutely off my shell. Anyway, that's the end of the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us to Merkage Dave.
Hey. Thank you for having me. It's been great fun.
Please come again, another time, again and again.
Again and again.
Yes. And also, thanks to Johnny Davis for joining us.
Thanks so much. It was really fun.
It was fun. Listeners, remember, you can get all the tunes on our rolling playlists on both Spotify and Tidal. Links are in the show notes. From me and Sean, from producers Alex Rees, Jelena Sofronievich, Elena Ganatra, and Jade Bailey, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
The Culture Bunker was produced and presented by Andrew Harrison and Sean Pattenden. The group editor was Andrew Harrison, and the producers were Jelena Sofronievich, Alex Rees, and me, Jay Bailey, with assistant production from Alina Ganatra. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Culture Bunker is a Podmasters production.